Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Whiskey Congress is back in session. This is a special bonus episode. With us is our markets guru, Ben, on the phone. He is at Existential, E-X-I-S-1-0-I-A-L on Twitter. He's a great follow. And with the election coming up, we want to talk about how that's going to impact the market. So, Steve, you want to chime in?
Yeah. Ben, thank you for joining us. Much appreciated. You are a great follow on Twitter. Especially as it relates to the market, and your unabashed disdain for Trump is hilarious.
Thank you.
But, you know, kind of jumping into it. So, you know, obviously we have the election coming up, on Tuesday, and, you know, it's highly contested. But so one of the things I kind of wanted to start this off with is taking a look at some of, you know, what Trump and his administration say are like the major sort of wins for them, reasons why people should be voting for them. And one of the first things they say is tax reform. You as a person who, you know, deals in the markets, you know, looking at the tax reform, what are your thoughts on the tax reform plan that they were able to get through? And, you know, is this something that they should be hanging their hat on? Or from your perspective, maybe is it something else?
Great question. And thanks to both you guys as well for having me back on. It's always a lot of fun to connect with you guys. And obviously heady times, right? It's been a while since we've connected. I think we connected near the March lows of COVID.
Yeah.
So obviously a lot's happened between then and now. And obviously, we've got election we're right on the cusp of. And so to your question, Steve, I do think that that's one area that is a valid claim from a policy standpoint from the Trump side of things, in that I do think it was helpful. Certainly, it was helpful with regard to the equity markets. But I think anecdotally in the business world, it was also helpful. And it was kind of combined with not just the tax relief, but also the deregulation. From my perspective, that was actually one area where I was certainly supportive of it in terms of just policy. However, you know, it was mitigated by other policies that were not so helpful. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that, particularly with regard to trade and tariffs,
right,
and how that's created headwinds. But I think to your question, I think that is, if they're going to hang their hat on one thing, tax reform was helpful to the business community. But I think what they would even maybe tout even a little bit louder with a little more fervor would be the judicial side and, you know, some of the judges that they've gotten more specifically the Barrett nomination that just materialized.
Yeah. And they definitely, I mean, the number of judges that they were able to get through is absolutely, you know, it's kind of absurd when you really think about it. Especially some of the people that they were able to get through, and, you know, more on in the lower federal courts, is bothersome just because you have a lot of people that are going to basically be growing up on the bench. A lot of people that are very young and very inexperienced, that now have control of our federal courts. And so that's something that has irked me, but I guess, you know, for the sake of our conversation in terms of, you know, markets and money and things like that, I didn't want to, you know, necessarily dive into that. But, so when you say that the tax reform was very beneficial for the business community and you applaud the deregulation, for the average guy, you know, making $50,000, $60,000 a year, do you think it was directly beneficial to them? Or is it just not quite that simple to break it down that way?
It's not quite that simple to break it down that way, but we can break it down and make it simple. And, there's a cascading effect to it. And, you know, forgive me for kind of alluding to what we'd call trickle-down economics, but there's a couple factors here. I mean, let me be very clear. Not everyone got a personal income tax break as it relates to that 2017 tax reform. In fact, there are factors of it that I really – first of all, I entered a higher tax bracket, just me personally, with that tax reform. Now, it was mitigated to some extent through the corporate side of things going from 28 to 21. But there were other factors that affected small business in terms of what you could write off. It also capped what you could write off in terms of if you're an itemized taxpayer as opposed to someone who just takes the standard deduction. So there was some things that were not exactly helpful from that perspective.
Right. That itemized versus the standard deduction, for some people and I can see where we can't say it's definitely not the same for everyone because,
right.
You know, like for some people, you know, the standard deduction being increased, right? Like that really kind of simplifies their taxes, right? Because before, you know, it was, you know, at a certain point, so they're looking at everything. They're looking at childcare. They're looking at all these different things and trying to add it up. And then, you know, it was barely kind of, you know, like people really had to run it both ways, as they say. But then by increasing that standard deduction, for a lot of people, it simplified it and maybe it helped them. But for other people, you know, with a number of deductions, maybe it really didn't do much for them, depending on what their situation is.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I don't think it helped per se the individual taxpayer in a direct sense, but it did in some ways indirectly, and I'll try to flesh that out. What it did encourage was CapEx spending, and for a lot of companies that involved, you know, adding to headcounts and things like that. So it did create more jobs in that sense, which, you know, again, indirectly helps, you know, John Q. taxpayer. But there are other aspects of it that actually created headwinds, and many of which were exacerbated by COVID. Now, keep in mind, this policy didn't go in place until 2017. One of the key deductions that was actually taken away was the travel and entertainment deduction. So business meals and things like that used to be 100% deductible. Trump actually did away with that. And then kind of in an about-face manner, which is typical of Trump, you know, 2 years later, he demanded that deduction, he decided that was a bad idea. Of course, he didn't take responsibility for having been the one that implemented that policy, but, you know, it suggested that should be looked at. So when you think about it that way and you combine that with what's happened with COVID, that's really created a lot more headwinds for some of these, you know, hospitality and leisure businesses that are, you know, obviously reliant on that revenue stream and just that subset, that sector of the economy to perform well, and just created an unnecessary headwind. Obviously, it didn't have the foresight that COVID would happen at that point, but that's also been kind of, exaggerated just because of the situation we're in with the pandemic. So, but yeah, to your point, just as a broad stroke, it didn't directly help John Q. taxpayer, but indirectly it did in terms of, you know, CapEx spending being increased, and overall more conducive business environment. But again, I don't want to tout this too much because, you know, this was largely mitigated by some of the other policies that turned out to be disastrous.
Right. The one thing I remember seeing a number of companies do some large stock buybacks, you know, right after that was passed. And that irked me in a big way. You know, I used to work for a big Fortune 500 company. And, we saw something like this, you know, in, I want to say 2009, 2010, maybe it was 2011. I can't remember the exact year, but they received a tax break. And then, you know, there was all these, you know, sort of promises of, you know, what you're hearing is just like, oh, because of this, then, you know, these corporations will be able to do more for the employees and will be able to, you know, whether it's training or bringing on more employees and all that stuff. And you know, everyone's getting all excited. And then the company does a giant stock buyback. And then all the CEOs get, you know, raises and all this other shit. And then we're all still left there. And then they're just like, oh, by the way, we're shutting down this particular part of the company, and having experienced that. So when I saw this, you know, in 2017, it was just kind of like, I was very, very wary of it. And then when I've
seen this movie before,
I've seen this before. And then when I start to see, the airlines doing large buybacks and everything else, I was like, okay, this does not feel any different.
Yeah. I mean, stock buybacks, it's controversial for obvious reasons. You know, the optics are certainly very bad given our current situation relative to COVID. As you guys are sure aware, you know, stock buybacks were suspended for those that participated in the Fed lending facilities post COVID. So they have restarted. You're seeing some companies announce new buybacks. It's an optics thing. I mean, I think from a business standpoint, it's a mechanism for which companies to return value to shareholders. Of course, not everybody's a shareholder, right? And so I think that's part of the gap that, you know, with our conversations and things that I post on social media, you know, to close that gap with regard to financial literacy and people that want to participate in you know, equity markets, because I think it's important for people to do that in terms of wealth generation. I mean, the United States stock market is the greatest wealth generator in the history of civilized, world. So to me, the optics are bad from a political standpoint, but when you understand the mechanisms and the reasons why they do it in terms of delivering that value to shareholders, I think it begins to make sense for individuals to start thinking, well, maybe it makes sense for me to own stock. And there's never been more access to the stock market for the individual investor than there is today. Obviously, with, you know, this landscape of commission-free trading, you also have fractional shares available to folks. You know, if you don't want to spend $3,000 on a share of Amazon, you can buy a fractional share of Amazon. So things like that. So I think it's a useful data point or political point to use to say, hey, let's have a larger conversation about financial well-being and how people can participate in the upside regardless of what your income streams are. But I agree with you, the optics are bad, certainly bad when you're in the midst of hopefully on the tail end and coming out of a recession, which, you know, obviously nobody would have predicted, you know, 2 years ago.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and you're 100% right as it relates to the market. Over the last, I would say 18 months, I've really kind of dug in myself. Obviously, you know, side conversations I've had with you, and then just a lot of sort of, learning and trial by fire. Right. You know, you've been on the receiving end of, God damn it, I got burned, text. Right. But I mean, you're right. I mean, the market does create these opportunities to generate wealth. Like, you don't need hundreds of thousands of dollars to get started. You save up $1,000 and you can learn how to grow that money, over a longer period of time. And then as you get a better understanding, there are, you know, some short-term ways to generate income as well. But it takes time and it takes effort and it really takes knowledge that a lot of people, I think, are afraid of. Right. And so for me, I think, on the one hand, you're right. I don't like the optics of the stock buyback. But in the meantime, you know, I'm so dug into the market that I can see the benefit of it and, you know, see, you know, like, well, this is good for me on this end, but I still don't like the way it looks, you know.
Yeah. I agree 100% because, you know, there again, I go back to that, kind of knowledge gap. And I'm not sure that a lot of people even fully appreciate the access that they have to markets that they hadn't had in the past. I mean, it used to be that, you know, it was a $7 or $8 commission on an equity trade where you might have only been buying 5 or 10 or 15, 20 shares.
Yeah.
And so your cost basis just got murdered. Because you were, you know, an armchair smaller time trader versus today where, you know, that headwind and that, you know, completely that kind of gone. Cost is removed from the equation. But also to your point, just with regard to trial and error and kind of learning by doing it, it's not unlike anything else, right? I mean, if you're learning a sport or learning a musical instrument or whatever, you get better by actually doing it. And, you know, nothing's free, right? I talk a lot about the market. It collects tuition, man. You know, you don't, unfortunately, you don't get to learn for free. Sometimes the market collects tuition from you. And so when you make that bad trade, and it feels painful for sure, but you just have to think of it as the cost of education, and it makes you a better trader. I mean, I think I've shared this with you guys in the past. I mean, I didn't really get proficient and feel competent until I lost a fuck ton of money, man. So, you know, that just, you know, you start to appreciate how that feels when you lose money, and you make sure that you don't want to do it again. So to your point, Steve, you really start to dig in and do your homework, and you avoid those mistakes moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, sometimes you just don't know, right? I mean, the market just does crazy things. Like, I using Microsoft as an example, Microsoft just had earnings this past week. I mean, their earnings, like, you know, listening to that call and listening to everything about it, you're just like, wow, they blew it, you know, out of the water. Yet that stock just, you know, crawled backwards. Now, a lot of that had to do with the fact that there was a large sell-off due to COVID concerns and things like that. But there's really no reason, like in a sane world, there's no reason why that Microsoft stock should have crawled backwards the way that it did, at least in my opinion. And I mean, you want to talk more about that? As an example, sorry.
No, I think that's it's a great example, because, you know, the strange thing about the markets, I mean, they can be irrational for sure. And, you know, sometimes good news is bad news. And I know that sounds crazy, but particularly when you talk about, you know, high frequency data or jobs reports or, you know, various economic indicators like CPI or PMI or you know, GDP, sometimes those factors can be viewed as negative when they, in fact, you know, appear to be positive, particularly with where we are. A lot of it had to do with stimulus and the lack of stimulus. You know, the better the numbers were going into that negotiation with Pelosi and, you know, obviously Mnuchin and Meadows, the better the data, the more leverage it gave to Republicans. And obviously, just from an ideological standpoint, they were they had less of an appetite, frankly, to, you know, execute a more robust package. So, you know, good news was bad news in that case, because the market wanted stimulus, but the better the data was, it suggested that maybe Republicans would be a little less likely to move more towards Pelosi's, proposal. So that's just one example. But to the Microsoft example, you know, that's an example where, you know, there was lack of guidance, and because of the uncertainty that COVID has, and again, this also plays into the lack of stimulus. To me, that's a large reason why, you know, Microsoft didn't perform well, even though they blew out. And same thing with, look at Amazon, blowout quarter, absolute blowout quarter. Same thing with Apple, with the exception of the iPhone numbers. They did miss on iPhone by almost $1 billion, which is pretty wild. Right. But a lot of that's due to China. A lot of that's due to the trade issues and tensions with China. So it's all interrelated. And I think that's another takeaway for, you know, people interested in markets and that, you know, want to kind of start to get their feet wet in risk assets. All this stuff's interrelated, you know, from geopolitics to macroeconomics, all the way down to domestic policy on a granular level. And the Microsoft example is just that. I mean, these guys blew it out of the water. It does create buying opportunities, right? But to have the, you know, the wherewithal and, you know, kind of the courage to jump in and take a position is another thing. And that's tough. And so that goes back to the psychology and the emotions of the investor that we've talked about in past conversations.
You know, so we've jumped into the, you know, we've dipped our toe in the Chinese waters. So why don't we just go ahead and kind of get into that. You know, early on, Trump talked about issues with China. You know, we labeled them a, you know, currency manipulator, and we kicked off this trade war. He put tariffs on them. They put some tariffs on us, and he claims that this is good for us and that China is paying for all of it. I don't believe that that is accurate or true. I've looked at the numbers. I've seen the data that pretty much says it's not true, but why don't you talk to us about it from your standpoint as a person who looks at the markets on a daily basis?
I mean, sure. Tariffs are literally a synonym for taxes. So, you know, the question becomes, you know, who pays that tax? And without question, it's the end user of those goods. And so when Trump talks about, you know, the Treasury, the U.S. Treasury collecting all this money from China, it's totally absurd. That's not the way it works. In fact, I can tell you that as somebody who was exporting whiskey from the U.S. into Canada, one of the retaliatory tariffs that we had to deal with was a 20% tariff against American originated liquid. And so, you know, that was a problem because ultimately, as we, you know, broke down the cost structures, you know, we couldn't be competitive on the shelf to the consumer because our price was going to be so out of the water and so uncompetitive versus domestic products because of that tariff that we decided we wouldn't even enter the Canadian market at that point in time. And so obviously there's a cascading effect there as well to the consumer. Not only would they have otherwise paid a higher price, a higher end price for our goods, they actually never had access to our goods because of the tariff in the first place. So it limits, you know, selection. And obviously it hurts us from a business standpoint in terms of scale and so forth. So yeah, the tariffs created a huge headwind. And when you think back about the last 3.5 years, this really started back in January 2017, if you guys remember, with solar panels and washing machines, of all things.
Right.
Before it evolved into the steel and aluminum. And then, of course, and it wasn't just China, right? It was with France on cheese and champagne. It was with Canada on steel and a few other items. It was with Mexico on agricultural items. So it was a global trade issue. And, you know, the old saying, you know, when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And that was Trump's approach, you know, is a blunt force object, and all he had was tariffs. And so every problem he had, he's like, oh, we'll just put tariffs on it. And yeah, at the end of the day, that's simply a tax. So again, you know, to your original question about tax reform and the benefits of it, you know, largely a lot of those were mitigated by these types of policy shifts that, by the way, I would add are very progressive in nature in terms of ideology. Conservatives have always touted the benefits of free trade, and this is very anti-free trade. So it really does strike me that, you know, the folks that are cheering on the Trump tariffs and the, you know, the stance towards China, they don't realize that this is literally the Bernie Sanders policy. And, you know, it's hard for them to wrap their mind around that because they really start to kind of realize they look pretty foolish.
Huh.
Well, I think a lot of the folks you're talking about are pretty good at talking out of both sides of their mouths. So saying something that actually does not hold water is not something they're afraid of.
That's true. That is true. And unfortunately, I think that's part of the, you know, just kind of the raised temperature, just given our proximity to an election. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, we'll get into the election piece too, I'm sure, here in a few minutes. But
right. But
I agree with you, Jim. And, you know, hopefully this cycle is useful in terms of, you know, educating folks on, you know, just macroeconomics and how some of these things work. Because one of the things Trump did in 2016, which he deserves a lot of credit for, is he engaged and mobilized a huge voting bloc that had never been involved in the electoral process. They had never registered to vote or had voted at all. And so a lot of first-time voters that came out for Trump. Now, granted, we could debate the ways in which he did it with, you know, xenophobia and, you know,
right. Some
tinged with racism and things like that. But without question, you know, that voting bloc exists now. They're a meaningful part of this election. And, you know, hopefully it does, because of their engagement, it gives us an opportunity to have a meaningful conversation and hopefully educate people on how all this stuff works, because, you know, they're definitely getting a mixed message, if not, I would say, just completely false message from the Trump campaign.
You know, so going into, you know, Trump's, I guess, access, right, to mm-hmm. to his you know, his followers and people that support his supporters. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how his, you know, his really his tweets, but, you know, his press conferences and things like that, how they've had an impact on the market. Like literally he tweets something, he says something, and the market does something pretty wonky. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, because I feel like we haven't seen that before to this level. With Trump, it feels intentional. Like with past presidents, it definitely, you know, like maybe they speak on a particular topic and the market reacts, where this feels different with Trump. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to your point, I mean, this is totally unprecedented. Governing by tweet is totally unprecedented. I mean, I think Barack Obama was one of the first presidents that really established a meaningful presence on social media. I mean, he had, you know, multiple Twitter accounts. He was active, but he wasn't governing through tweet. It was far more, ancillary. It was just kind of weighing in on, and it was mostly, just reinforcing policy messaging that was coming out of the administration anyway. It was
succinct.
It wasn't so specific to policy decisions in real time. And that's right. Where Trump has completely blown apart all those norms. And, you know, he's repeatedly attacked American U.S. companies, you know, publicly traded companies during market hours, which raises a lot of concerns, you know, SEC concerns that I think are legitimate about potential, you know, obviously insider trading or just front running trades. So from my perspective, that's been one of the biggest concerns and headwinds, as well as I mentioned the China piece and the trade policy. But the, you know, we call it tweet risk in the markets.
Did that term exist prior to Trump?
No, absolutely not. It only began when it really started with Boeing. One of the original attacks Trump made on Twitter was Boeing, because he didn't like the contract they had with Air Force One. And so he attacked Boeing. I think Boeing dropped about 6% that day, like intraday. Like he made the attack around 10 a.m. or something after markets opened, and the stock just absolutely tanked. And of course, you know, a lot of people don't realize they have exposure to Boeing. I mean, Boeing is a part of most mutual funds. It's a part of a lot of ETFs out there. And so even if you don't own Boeing directly, but you have a 401k, guess what? You probably have exposure to Boeing, and it probably hurts you pretty bad, because Boeing is a huge market cap company, part of a global duopoly with Airbus, obviously. And so that was one of the first examples. And then he would attack Amazon consistently because of Jeff Bezos and his ownership of the Washington Post, and obviously their coverage of. And so that's another example. I mean, most recently, people will remember the Goodyear. He actually went out at Goodyear, Northeast Ohio company.
Right here. Now,
probably one of the largest employers in Northeast Ohio, second to the Cleveland Clinic. Huge company, wonderful company with just tons, you know, impressive lineage and everything else. And he actually went out and called for a ban because he actually misinterpreted something that was coming out of like an HR deck. I mean, it was just totally ridiculous.
Right.
And so, of course, the stock, you know, dropped about 6 or 7% intraday on that day. So, yeah, to your point and question, we've never seen anything like it. And it has caused jitters in the market. And to me, it's also a headwind. And so when we think about Biden and when we start to talk about potential, strategies and how a Biden, administration might impact markets, you know, eliminating that type of risk is also meaningful. It's not quite as meaningful as alleviating the China tensions and things like that. But it is meaningful just with regard to the psychology of traders and just, you know, kind of walking on eggshells with Trump and just, you know, kind of being prepared for anything. So,
yeah, it's funny.
We've never seen it before.
You know, just speaking from experience, you know, there have been times where, you know, like I get an alert on my phone, you know, the Fox News alert, you know, Trump going live, press conference about so-and-so. And I have to seriously look at my positions and say, should I get out of these? You know, is he going to say something right now that's going to fucking kill me? And there have been a couple of times where I felt so uneasy that I actually sold off and got out. And, you know, thankfully that I did, because of course, you know, like he said something ridiculous and it caused a sell-off. So, it's just so bizarre that, you know, it's coming from our president, the way that it is. And I have to say that me personally, I'll be glad whether I like him or not, it's just the amount of additional stress and frustration that he brings to some of the, you know, to various things in my life. It's just like, I need you to go away. You know, I mean, it's like breaking up with that crazy girlfriend. It's just like, look, none of the sex, none of it is worth it anymore. I just need you to go away.
Yeah. Well, two things to that. First is that that's one area where the Biden campaign's done a really good job of messaging. I think they did a campaign ad, or maybe it wasn't an ad, but it was kind of a talking point in which they pointed out that, you know, Joe Biden doesn't need to be the center of attention, right? He's going to be a president that kind of fades into the background and just, you know, kind of, you know, takes on more of an administrative capacity as opposed to, you know, this reality show showman type horseshit that we've gotten, unfortunately, somewhat numb to. The other piece that you mentioned about trading around, you know, events or you know, commentary from a Trump, et cetera. It's, and I know how frustrating it can be, obviously. It's really, really tough to do it. In fact, not something I would generally encourage. And I say that because of this. If you own something and you believe in it and it's part of your thesis, it shouldn't be affected at all by something Trump would say or do. So, and also you have to think about tax implications and things like that. So there's a range of things to think about when you actually exit or enter positions. And it's really tough not to do it because, like you said, you know, when you get that, you know, that uneasiness, you're like, oh, shit, you know, if this thing rolls over 6, 7, 8 points in a day, you know, it might put you in a bad situation.
Right.
But keep in mind, in fact, I would actually say it might be an opportunity to dollar cost average and add to that position because right. more often than not, I've looked at various examples of this where Trump does attack a company and almost 90, 95% of the time that company ends up coming right back to where it was trading prior to his comments. And so, it goes back to what I had mentioned earlier about psychology and emotions.
Right. You got
to
weather the storm.
If you're going to trade with frequency and trade intraday, that's probably the toughest thing to master is just being able to get control of your emotions because it can, because we're talking about real money here, right? We're not talking about monopoly money.
Right.
So it's people's well-being. And so it can be very easy to just get uneasy and in some ways overreact. And, you know, it's, yeah, you want to have a thesis and have confidence in what you own. And if you do, you can weather those types of storms and, in fact, potentially benefit from them.
Good to know. Good to know. You know, I'm working on it, Ben. I'm working on it.
Pay the tuition still.
Yeah, definitely. I'm definitely still owe on my tuition here. So let's talk about the election from the views of the market.
Sure.
You know, I guess, you know, what is the market telling us about this election? You know, what can we glean from, you know, all the charts and all the candlesticks and all that sort of stuff? What is that telling us, or what is it telling you about the direction this election is going?
That's a really great question, and it's obviously something I've spent a lot of time thinking about it, looking at, and, you know, a couple of things. I mean, for example, like JP Morgan, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, they've put together these baskets of stocks and so have basically created these models of names that they think would benefit from a Biden presidency and those that would benefit from a Trump presidency. Now, we can get into the weeds on what those names are and so forth, but the easiest way to describe it is, you know, the Trump stocks are the reopen stocks, you know. So if you can imagine just, you know, if we just went back to business as usual and COVID were not part of the equation any longer, those types of names versus the Biden stocks, which have generally been regarded as the, you know, the COVID kind of stay at home trade or cloud tech AI type trade, these companies that have really flourished in this context of COVID. And so if you look at those baskets and those various actuarial models, clearly the market's pricing in a Biden presidency. That's actually pretty undeniable. Now, granted, as the polls, as you know, with our proximity to the election, the polls have tightened and the markets have reflected that. As you guys know, we had the sell-off that really kind of triggered in the first week of September. We had the rally right up into that. Went the very first Republican debate, which was a complete, you know, fucking debacle. And, you subsequently, I think a week later, had the Trump test positive for COVID.
Yeah, you meant the presidential debate. That was not a Republican.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
My apologies. Misspoke. Yes. The presidential, the first presidential debate. And after the Trump positive test, which of course was very damaging for him politically, given his stance on COVID, it's, you know, remember, it's miraculously going to go away. Remember, it's going to go away in the spring. We were going to open up at an Easter time and, you know, don't let it dominate your life and all this other nonsense. So when he was, in fact, I remember that night because the, you know, the futures market rolled over big time after he was tested positive. And then we ripped right on to almost getting back to those September highs. And so what that was telling us, because it was so damaging for his campaign, was that, you know, the market at that point was essentially pricing in this Biden victory. So it was interesting for me to watch, you know, the futures markets. And that's one aspect of it. The baskets are the other aspect. And again, I mentioned the kind of stay at home trade versus, which, you know, can be kind of attributed to Biden, whereas the stay at home trade, I'm sorry, the reopen trade attributed to Trump. The other wrinkle to it is renewable energy. I think that's, and we can talk about that too in a little bit in terms of, because Steve, you mentioned, you know, what are some strategies that might make sense in a Biden administration? We'll get back to that. But that's also an area. In fact, I remember making some posts about this, thinking about back in August when we were actually hedging out and putting a strategy in place for a potential Biden administration. And those trades, of course, have materialized, thankfully, as planned, and I think are also indicative of the market assuming that we'll see a Biden presidency. However, as we get closer to the election, just like we've seen in multiple election cycles in the past, the polls tend to tighten, and we've seen that here. And to some extent, that's part of why we've seen the market roll over a little bit. We've seen the VIX skyrocket. When you look at the VIX contracts, so not just the VIX, just when you think, not to get wonky here, but the VIX.
Yes, if you could explain on that, that would help someone like me.
So can I just take a stab at this?
Can you what?
Can I take a stab at this?
Yeah, sure.
All right, so when I look at the VIX, like, so VIX and there's also VXX, right, which are similar. And another one I also look at is SQQ. I kind of look at those as or SQQQ. I almost look at those as sort of like indicator stocks, right? Like, so when SPY is going up, then your VXX and your VIX, those are going to be going down, right? Like, not by a lot, but you're going to see them basically in terms of colors. Like, if SPY is green, then VXX and VIX are going to be red. And then vice versa, if, you know, if the SPY is going down, right, you're having like a big sell-off, then essentially like they're volatility stocks, right? Like, so as the market gets more volatile and things get more unsure, then that's where people go to basically hedge and say, all right, this is basically my safe space until all of this, you know, starts to turn itself around.
How do you do?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically true. Yeah, that's it's a basic framework of what these names are. So a couple of things, like SQQQ, for example, that's a short Q, so that's specific to the NASDAQ. That's basically a bet that the NASDAQ's going to go lower. So it is a contrarian, you know, type of instrument to use. Now, keep in mind, it's a triple leveraged instrument, so it's extremely volatile, and it's three times leveraged. So if the NASDAQ drops 2%, SQQQ will go up 6%, right? And vice versa. If NASDAQ goes up 2% and you're long SQQQ, you're coming down 6%. So it's not, I don't recommend a lot of people
getting right.
Use that mechanism just because it's not meant for buy and hold strategies. It's really meant for tactical trading.
Like, I literally just look at them. I would never invest in, you know.
Yeah. You wouldn't invest them anyway. You'd trade them for sure.
Right.
And then with regard to the VIX, so the VIX is a lot like a commodity, right? It trades in contracts. And so the VIX that we see published every day on Fox Business or CNBC or Bloomberg, that is the front month VIX contract. You guys will remember when we talked about WTI back in, I don't know how many months ago that was, when oil market was extreme. This was around the COVID.
Yeah, that was back in March.
And you guys remember oil going negative and people were thinking, right, we're going to get paid to own oil. That's not exactly how it works. But The VIX is the same way. It trades in contracts. So when you see the VIX published on your CNBC ticker, they're talking about that front month contract. Well, you can also trade subsequent month contracts. And so a few of the indicators we've been looking at leading up into the election to basically gauge how the market is pricing it and what the market is trying to tell us, looking at the VIX, the November contract, and looking at the VIX December contract, and how those have kind of, the dynamics of those versus not just the VIX, but also the major averages, particularly S&P and NASDAQ. And so, yeah, the VIX is essentially thought of as a fear gauge. Although it's important to note, sometimes the VIX goes higher along with the market, and that tells you something too, because the VIX is a derivative of the options market. So one of the reasons why the VIX has stayed elevated throughout this period since the COVID lows, the VIX has stayed consistently above 20. Now, 20 is generally, I mean, at least in a normal time, 20 is considered like kind of the panic level. When you're above 20, the market is highly volatile and there's a lot of uncertainty and panic in the market. But now it's been above 20 since March. So it's a derivative of the options market. And part of the dynamic that's so unique about this environment we're in, and you guys have probably seen me post a little bit about this, a lot of the speculative investors, the day trader global types, right? A lot of this, younger kids with some Robinhood accounts, they're stepping into the market. And a lot of them are simply using options because they can't afford 100 share lots of, Apple or 100 shares of, SPX even. And so they're buying options, and they're buying naked options. That's called punting. When you're just buying naked options, you don't own the underlying asset. You're just buying a call, assuming that it's going to go higher.
And they're buying out of the money as well.
Yeah. And so people like me and other dealers, we write those contracts. We're on the other side of that trade. We're selling them to them. Now, we have to own the underlying asset. So what ends up happening is when you have this huge influx of options buying, particularly call buying, it works with puts too, because if you're going to write a put contract, you have to own that asset as well. But this has really been more to the upside on the call side. We have to own those underlying assets to hedge the position. So if I write a contract, I have to own that stock. And so as those calls continue to pile up and people pour into the market betting on higher prices, the market inherently gets bid up because people like me are buying the stock to hedge the position and to write the contract. So it ultimately reaches a crescendo when it does roll over and a lot of these options start to expire worthless. Then you unwind that trade as a dealer, and that creates, an acceleration to the downside. So I know this sounds kind of confusing and wonky, but...
Well, it's like, so for me, I'm one of those like options traders that, like feed the beast of you guys who own the underlying stocks, right? Like, so I couldn't afford, and even like trying to buy options on an Amazon account is like crazy, right? Like, so I've done it, but I've done it more conservatively. So I'll buy a naked call or a naked put. But typically, 99% of the time it's in the money, right? Or right around the money. And I put a lot of work into figuring out that it's a move that makes sense. Now, I got burned a couple times, but I've also seen a couple really big successes, and it's a way to help generate income for someone who doesn't have the money to buy the underlying stock. And so, I've seen, the first one where I hit really big was with DraftKings. I put a lot of, and you and I had talked about it, and your initial suggestion was like, go out and buy, 100 shares of DraftKings. I was like, okay, well, I don't have $5,000 right now, Ben. Okay. So we're going to go another way. So I did the naked call, and, it ended up working out, and it made sense. my trade strategy and the theory behind it made sense. I tried it again with work, aka Slack, and got burned. But I did, there was something there it was a little bit smaller, and I think you and I talked about that one as well. A really big success I had was just recently with NIO. It's an electric vehicle maker out of China. It's a company that I felt strongly about and early on saw some success with them, and I have stuck with them, and I believe that they will continue to grow. Now, my concerns with our relationships with China and everything like that. I don't know that NIO would be as impacted as some of the other ones, because it's a company that's in China and they're not looking to export out to us, at least as it is right now. But NIO is another company that I've had success with a naked call. Now, I am very aware of, the risks on my side. Sure. But I think if you're a person that is willing to be, if you're willing to study and you're willing to take the time to, understand what the charts are telling you, taking the time to understand candlesticks, understanding what these patterns are, and understanding sort of not only the technical analysis, but the fundamental analysis, willing to listen to the news and kind of read the tea leaves, then there can be some benefit, but there's a huge risk. And I see a lot of people who will just jump into these calls and they'll say, oh, I can afford this call because it's only 69 cents. And, it would need a stock to jump like $12, and they get chewed up on the Greeks, and, people don't even understand the Greeks. They don't understand theta. They don't understand, how to, what you're getting out of the delta. And, sure. They just get killed on these deals and they can't figure out why. It's just like, well, you needed that stock to jump at least $5 for you to make a profit, and you needed it to happen today. And you were basically losing money if anything else happened at any other time, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the challenge with options. And to your point, I mean, first of all, it's important to understand options are inherently leveraged instruments, right? They're 100 factor. So any one contract is worth 100 shares. So it's immediately juiced up and levered up. So, and of course, the second aspect is, of course, these can expire worthless. So you could lose everything you wager. In this case, I say wager, invest, maybe another way to put it. But, options are a little different. You and I talked about this, Steve. I mean, a couple of things to remember. And so very important, and you kind of touched on it, because it really is important to do the homework and understand the nature of the underlying asset, and also understand the industry, the context, what are the potential catalysts they're going to take it higher or lower, what are the political risks, headline risks, etc. But you got to be right on three factors, and that's what makes it tough, because the more factors that you have to be right on, that means there's more opportunity for you to be wrong. And so with options, you have to be right on, first of all, directionally, right? You have to know if it's going to go higher or lower. You have to be right on strike price. So you have to kind of have a sense of where it's going to be. Like you had mentioned, you're, staying more within the money type options, which is obviously provides you a little bit of cover. And then the third part is expiration. You have to be right on timing. So you got to be right on all three of those if it's going to be a successful trade. Again, if you're punting, if you're just using naked options as an instrument. Now, if you're using them as hedges, which is a different strategy. I use options mostly as hedges. It's insurance, and you hope that you never make money on those, because you'd prefer to just let those expire out of the money and worthless, because you're basically protecting yourself to the downside. But so that's the challenge with options, is that you have to be right on three various factors. But to your point, because they're leverage instruments, when you're right, you're really right. Right. You can really make some great money. And it's also important, I think it's actually a good tool too, to develop your instincts and your psychology, in that you have to be willing to sell, and you have to be willing to sell when you hit certain.
That's
the hard part.
Yeah. That's the hard part. I mean, with, NIO this past week, like typically I'm a 30% guy. Right. Yeah. So if I do a call option and I hit 30% profit, then I sell. Now, Friday, NIO really started to kind of rip. And, about 10:30, it had already surpassed 30, or it had surpassed 29. It was at 28. I had bought contracts, in the money at, you know, like 27.48, I believe, is what it was. Mm-hmm. And then market open, it had jumped to, you know, 28.50 and was going to 29 and was approaching 30. And, you know, I was beyond that 30%. And at about 10.30 a.m., it started to kind of jump back. And so I had a decision to make. You know, it's, okay, do I... You know, the candlesticks are telling me that, you know, it's going to go down. But the question is, how long is it going to stay down? And, you know, is it going to start to sell off, or do I hold it and see what happens? Now, typically, like I said, once I get to that 30% mark, I just cut my ties. I take my 30% profit and say, where else are you going to make 30% on anything, right? I held it and it ended up, you know, closing a lot higher. You know, I think it ended up closing at like 31.50. So it was a pretty profitable day for me, given the number of contracts that I had purchased. And it was worth it. And, you know, but I was sweating that whole time. And, you know, I sold the contracts right around, like, you know, 3.45, and was really happy with the profit at that point in time. But that was risky as hell. Right. I mean, in my whole, like, I mean, it pretty much ruined my Friday, you know, constantly looking, you know, like looking at my phone and, you know, like, do I need to pull the trigger now? Do I need to pull the trigger now? And, you know, finally I did. And, you know, it was a big relief off my shoulder because I had made a fair amount of money and, you know, I was happy, but it's just like, Jesus Christ, how do you do this all day, every day?
Yeah, believe me, I understand. And it's just, that's the other component that's so different from just owning equities versus trading options, or, you know, a hybrid of the two. It does require 100% of your bandwidth if you're going to trade, particularly short expirations. And so, yeah, it can really kind of tie you up in terms of just keeping eyeballs on it. But, you know, again, you know, we had talked earlier about punting versus, you know, hedging. And, you know, when you do own the underlying asset, that's another, and this is, and we can talk about this offline, but, you know, you can put on spread trades where you're, you know, you're buying the calls but selling the puts against the same asset, you know, so it gives you a little bit more peace of mind because you may have a spread that, you know, you defined your risk, you know, you're not going to lose all your money because it's going to kick in if the stock, you know, falls below a certain point. So it's almost like using a trailing stop order on just owning an underlying equity. So there's ways you can put on options trades that'll hedge your downside. And you know, we can talk about that offline and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it's really, really useful that you're doing this and you're learning it, because not only are you just, you know, you're learning the terminology and the mechanics of how it all works, but you're honing your own style, you're honing in your instincts, and you're honing in your, you know, your psychology, getting control of your emotions. And that's, honestly, that's literally probably 75-80% of the game is just, you know, staying in control and not overreacting and keeping a cool head and just managing risk.
Well, I'm doing all this, Ben, so I could come work for Steelyard. And, you know, I mean, me and you could be like, you know, Michael Douglas and Charlie Sheen.
You got a home at Steelyard, man.
Blue Horseshoe loves Steelyard.
Yeah. When you're ready to dive in, it's funny. One of my former colleagues from the whiskey side, you know, he and I, we talk a lot because he's, you know, he's in the same shoes, you know, he's really getting feet wet and, he's really engaged. I mean, he's you know, he's got the appetite for this stuff, and he's really, you know, an analytical mind. And I've always told him, I said, man, you could be a phenomenal analyst. And so I'll give him these, you know, I'll give him a sector and say, you know, to dive into this sector and give me a few names that you think, and give me a thesis, you know, give me a 60, 90, 120 a day, you know, kind of projection of where you think these are going to be priced and so forth. And he's great. And, yeah, I mean, look, we're growing by the way, I appreciate you plugging Steelyard. I mean, the fund is just, I can't believe how far this thing has come in such a short time. And, you know, I certainly look to expand it. And yeah, Steve, I mean, we've got a home for you when you're ready.
Good deal, man. Cause this whole thing with affordable housing, I don't know.
I didn't know. I didn't know I was actually sitting through a job interview.
Yeah.
Well, no. Well, fuck Jim. Hey man, we'll get you on board too, brother. I still remember our trade, Jim, from way back when we were talking about Beyond Meat. and you know, shorten that stock. It's actually a great example of, you know, just creating firm exit points, because, you know, Beyond Meat obviously ripped after it hit the lows after we talked about short.
Yeah.
And
If I had gone with Steve's 30% rule on that, I'd be a much happier guy now.
Yeah, but it's good. It's good to define your risk like that, and it's good to really stick within those parameters, because it's easy to get greedy. And, you know, one of the things I remember when you and I, us guys, when you guys first had me on and we talked about the markets, you know, one of the axioms that I always preach is just, it's really easy to know what to buy, because, you know, you get these mania stocks and, you know, we've seen it all over. I mean, we've seen it with Bitcoin and crypto. We've seen it recently with EVs. You know, you've seen it most recently with renewable energy and solar. I mean, the TAN, TAN, that ETF, I mean, Christ, you look at what that's done. And look at FDN. I mean, just the, you know, the mega cap internet thing from First Trust. I mean, that thing has just been just an absolute rocket ship. You know, it's easy to know what to buy, but it's so hard to know when to sell. And the only way to do it is create those parameters and really stay disciplined and stick to your guns.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great way to finish up. You know, Ben, we appreciate every time you come on. We always definitely learn something. Hopefully our listeners do as well. You know, I thought it was important that, you know, we kind of talk about some of this stuff and give people an opportunity to soak it in. We're going to release this Sunday evening so people can, you know, listen to it. And if there's something in there that they can pull out, then, you know, Monday morning, 9:30, when the market opens, and maybe they can make a move or something, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will just leave you guys with this thought, too, just on that note, because, you know, elections obviously happening Tuesday. You know, there is some concern about whether we'll see you know, contested result or some kind of protracted litigated outcome. You know, I'm a little bit on the contrarian side, thinking that we will see a more decisive outcome. That's what's anticipated. But I do want people to feel comfortable that, you know, one of the pieces of messaging coming out of the Trump campaign has been, you know, the 401k is going to crash, stock market's going to crash if Trump doesn't get reelected. You know, the market's clearly, kind of debunked that notion. So, you know, of course, we're going to see volatility, market's going to chop around, but I certainly don't think you're going to see the market completely fall off a cliff just because there's a Biden administration. In fact, I think it doesn't matter who's elected, if it's right. Trump or Biden, I think the market is ready to go higher. We just need a decisive outcome. So I think our best case scenario from an equity standpoint is to see a decisive outcome. That way we can put it behind us and start thinking about, okay, how are we pricing policy moving forward? And I think the market's poised to go higher in either direction.
Right, because no matter who gets elected, I think the market is anticipating that, okay, once we get this resolved, then we will get the stimulus situation resolved as well. And that is something that can probably help prop the market up as well.
Yeah, and those are the two key components, because if it is a Biden administration, we eliminate the headwinds that we talked about when we first started the conversation here with regard to China trade and with regard to the tweet risks and, you know, some of the other issues that are related to Trump. And of course, you're going to get a much more robust stimulus package from a Biden administration. Now, if Trump's reelected, obviously, you're going to keep the tax cuts. And so that's going to be baked into the cake. And you're going to get stimulus at some point, just might not be as robust. So I agree 100% with that assessment, Steve. I think we're going to go higher either way, but we just need that decisive outcome to really kind of quell the fears that are out there right now.
And how long of a you know, period of uncertainty would it take to be a real risk to the market? If we don't have a decision or a likely decision by Wednesday, that's not going to surprise me. But if this goes into the middle of November, you know, approaching Thanksgiving, how do you think the market would react to that?
It'd be a problem. We'll go lower. I mean, keep in mind, we've already rolled over. We're already in correction territory off the recent highs. So we're about, just on the NASDAQ, we're a little over 10% off that high, that recent high from October. So, yeah, I mean, we could get, you know, 15, maybe back into bear territory, 20% off that high if we have this protracted, you know, litigated, contested result. But my sense is, and again, this is a little bit contrarian, a lot of folks might not necessarily agree with me, but I think we have a result by Friday or maybe even Monday of the following week. So, but yeah, to your point, Jim, if we go out to Thanksgiving, the market will grind lower and lower until we get some clarity.
I certainly hope that doesn't happen, but I'm not ruling it out as a possibility.
Well, that's why hedging is so important. It's not sexy. Hedging's never sexy until it is sexy, right? So it's important to just protect your downside. And for folks out there that are just, you know, kind of getting into the markets, it's, you know, there's various mechanisms you can use, but I think the best mechanism you can use is just what's happening between your two ears, and just make sure you're ready for a wild ride, especially these next coming weeks.
Well, that's a perfect way to wrap it up. Is there anything you want to pitch before we go?
No, sir. No, I appreciate it, guys. I always love coming on with you, and you know, let's hope we get a decisive outcome, and you know, best of luck in the markets. But like I said, I always appreciate it. It's always a lot of fun.
Always good having you on. This is Ben, who is at Existential, EXIS10IAL on Twitter. He's a great follow on Twitter. You can follow us at Whiskey Congress on Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening, and we hope this was interesting and informative.